delighted to have with us for the second case some of our students from Nishikant High School. Would they please stand? Well, welcome to you. We had some of your colleagues earlier this morning. Won't you be seated? And we also have some students from Colby High School. Would they stand? And welcome to you all also. Please be seated. The students are here today with a national prize-winning program that the State Bar and the Supreme Court sponsor, and that it's called Court with Class. And the students have received synopses of the case that we are all about to hear, and there are synopses of this case outside on one of the tables if anyone here would like one. The students will join up with other students from Michigan High School at the end of this hearing, and Justice Babbage will talk with you about the processes and procedures of this court. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With the introductions made, we'll go to the second case, David I. versus Labor and Industry Review Commission, 97-1649. Mark Andrews is representing McFarland Pheasant Farm, Inc. Mr. Andrews.
Thank you, Attorney Mark Andrews, on behalf of McFarland Pheasant Farm, the employer at Rural Mutual Insurance Company, their workers' compensation carrier. This case involves the question whether the benefit to the employer doctrine under workers' compensation law should extend to injuries which occur during personal activities. In this case, that personal activity by Mr. Ide was changing a tire so he could go grocery shopping after work. The rules would be that such an injury is not compensable. Mr. Ide stepped outside the boundaries of his work for which he was employed when this injury happened. Now, preparing this case for argument, I tried to think of a way to analyze it that wasn't simply a repetition of the arguments that I've presented in my brief. The only thing I could come up with really was by trying to look at what this case was not. There are any number of kind of subcategories under workers' compensation law that have developed over the course of the years that deal with questions of whether an injury is work-related. Any number of categories. This is not a deviation case. It's not a commuting case.
It's not a what case after deviation?
Commuting case, or also known as a coming and going case.
Counsel, we're having just a little difficulty hearing you. Maybe you could either step up or raise the podium just a little bit.
You get a little closer to the microphone.
A little closer.
By raising the podium, you will get a little closer.
There's a button on your far left side, far left upper side. That's it.
Magic.
There you go.
This is high tech.
I didn't know that.
You got a state employee, believe me, who pushes up to get the second.
Your second point was not commuting, and your first point was?
It's not a deviation case. It's not a personal comfort case. It's not a traveling employee case. It's not a lot of things. I mean, there are any number of other categories of cases that have been cited in the briefs of both ours and my opponent that touch on these issues, and they're pertinent in some respects, but they don't necessarily answer the question. This case doesn't fit neatly into any of those categories. However, I think we can use some of the principles applicable to those cases in analyzing this situation. We start with the statute, start with the basics, WSSTAT section 102.03, subsection 1C. in order to be a compensable injury, employee has to be performing service growing out of and incidental to his or her employment. Basic facts showing Mr. Ide's injury was not growing out of and incidental to his employment. He had completed work for the day. He was embarking on what the Labor and Industry Review Commission, LIRC, called a, quote, purely personal errand, end of quote.
In the record, just so I understand it, after, when he fixed the tire, did he then continue on his personal mission?
He did not, because he had suffered the injury.
Okay.
He was going to the grocery store. That was his plan. Those facts started at the hearing level. They've been affirmed by every tribunal since then.
Now, he's not attributing his back injury to anything else other than that tire event.
Right.
Is that right?
Correct.
No pre-existing
back. He did have a complaint of some pre-existing back problems.
Was that prior to his coming to McFarland Pheasant Farms, or was that, I saw in the facts, that because there was a back problem, he was to avoid heavy lifting. But was this problem something that developed while he was working at McFarland, or was it before he came to McFarland?
Perhaps a little of both. Mr. Ide came to Wisconsin to work at an agricultural internship here at McFarland Pheasant Farm. He originally hailed from Massachusetts. We have copies of records from Massachusetts before this incident, before he came to Wisconsin, that indicated he had some back problems. He then indicated to his employer prior to this incident that the work that he was doing was giving his back some problem, and for that reason the employer said, well, don't do any heavy lifting. Under the standard review, as far as the facts are concerned, findings of fact have to be accepted if supported by credible and substantial evidence. If you want me to argue whether the facts are supported by the evidence, I'll do so. Otherwise, I'll move on to analyzing those facts in light of the
applicable. I did have a question, and I haven't had an opportunity to look at the administrative law judge's findings of fact, but I do know that the commission's finding says that after applicant punched out and had completed work for the day, he began driving the employer's van to the grocery store. Now, from what I can glean from this record, the flat tire occurred in front of the shop.
Right.
How far was the shop from the entrance to the farm?
I know, because I've been out there. It's about 35 yards or so. It's not, I don't think, in the record.
Well, are they disputing that he was on his way to the grocery store when the flat tire occurred?
They have disputed that.
Where did they say he was going?
They said he had been asked to finish his regular duties for the day, was done with his regular job, and had been asked by his foreman, or Richard Stevens, to help him clean out the garage.
Counsel, I assume then, with that assertion, since Lurk found that he had completed work for the day, that Lurk did not accept that assertion of fact.
Exactly.
What then, do take a moment and pause to tell me, if you will, what credible and substantial evidence is there in the record to support Lurk's finding that he had completed work for the day?
One, his regular work day ended at 5:30. His time card showed that he had signed out or punched out at 5:30. The evidence is that this accident involving the tire happened around 6 o'clock. The employer, the president of McFarland Pheasant Farm, testified that Mr. Ide had asked him during that day, can I take the van, which is one of a couple different vehicles that were used on the farm, can I take the van to go grocery shopping after work? And he said, yes, you may. The other testimony was by foreman Richard Stevens, who said, I never asked Mr. Ide to stay after work to help me. I was in another part of the farm. I talked to him earlier in the day, and he told me he was going to be using the van after work to go grocery shopping. And when I was coming back to the shop area, I saw him with the van, trying to change the tire. He indicated that he had already hurt his back, and he asked me, meaning Mr. Stevens, could you please help me change the tire?
Well, I testified that he did not punch it out, right? Punch
he
out
did.
The... And was it a normal punch out or was it written in?
A number of time cards were submitted as evidence at the hearing. On 22 today, and they did have a punch clock that was utilized on some occasions. On 22 other occasions during this course of employment, you know, up until the date of the injury, the time had been signed out. So it went both ways.
And what was it here?
In this case, it was written in.
Was it Ide's signature, or was it Ide's handwriting?
He testified it was not his handwriting. We didn't have a handwriting expert at the hearing. Mr. Stevens said it was not his handwriting. Mr. McFarland said it was not his handwriting. So that's a bit of a...
Did it differ from the other 22 by looking at it?
I have no handwriting analysis, Judge.
But the administrative law judge found that he had checked out.
Right.
So in this case, based on the questions of... the other justices, it's my understanding that as far as this issue we're talking about, that the LERC, the Circuit Court, and the Court of Appeals all found that these facts were credible, that you're discussing.
Right.
What's the standard, credible and substantial?
The facts were stated by LERC, affirmed by the Circuit Court, even affirmed by the Court of Appeals with one exception that they deemed not really relevant. That was the issue of whether he regularly used this vehicle during the course of his employment, you know, his regular work day. There had been a finding that he had not. The testimony was that he had used this vehicle, another vehicle picked up, every day or every other day.
Now, you're not challenging any of these findings of fact. You're challenging only the ultimate conclusion. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
I'm supporting LERC's ultimate conclusion.
Right. What does this court do about the ultimate conclusion? What's the standard of review for the ultimate conclusion?
Well, it's a question of law, so you can certainly review it de novo. But LERC's ruling, I think, is something that is within their expertise and as such should be given great weight deference.
To LERC, right. Not the administrative law judge.
Right.
Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Could I ask you, sir, was there any dispute in the facts between the administrative law judge and LERC?
No.
It's only on the law.
Actually, what happened was we had raised this issue of, was this a work-related injury? And that was one of the issues at the hearing. The administrative law judge found all these facts and then issued an award on some PPD, permanent partial disability, also came to medical expenses. Didn't do any analysis whatsoever of whether this was actually a work-related injury, but by implication, obviously found that it was, because an award was made. At that point, there were some findings that were appealed to LERC by us, some findings that were, or rulings that were appealed by Mr. Ide. And among those issues that we appealed was, is this a work-related issue or work-related injury?
Maybe this is unfair to ask you, but were there any findings of fact by the administrative law judge that were not used by LERC and that would have been helpful to Mr. Ide?
I don't think so. The administrative law judge said he had punched out of work for the day. He was done with work for the day. He was using the van to go grocery shopping.
Is there a transcript of the testimony?
There is. I don't know if it's part of your record, but there is one. LERC's findings or rulings of law in this matter, I think, should be given great weight deference. Now, unfortunately, in terms of the analysis, the facts of the case don't fit neatly into any number of these different categories of cases that determine whether an injury is growing or incidental to employment.
Well, you said it's not a deviation. What's the rule on deviations? A deviation needs to go from A to B, and it goes A, C, B, right? That's the general deviation.
In essence, I mean, there are different variations on that theme as well.
Right. So what's the rule?
Well, in a deviation or a detour case, those involve a situation where a person is definitely within the course of their employment. They then deviate from that employment in some respect, either in terms of their activities, in terms of where they're going, their location, whatever. And the question then becomes whether the deviation was so significant as to take the activity out of the scope of employment. Some of the deviation, I don't think this is a deviation case, such as runs or NICOR, or some of the cases that have been briefed in this manner.
Why not? Because he stopped work and he wasn't going anywhere on a work-related matter? Is
exactly.
That why?
It wasn't a deviation because he wasn't working, so he didn't have anything to deviate from.
Well, did he ever have control of the automobile in part of his work? I mean, this van, did he ever use it?
In the course of his regular work day, on occasion, yes.
Okay. So why, the second one that you said is what, it's not commuting. What's the rule on commuting?
Commuting cases are a situation where you've got an employee who is going to and from his work in the usual and ordinary way.
Doesn't coming and going also have as a condition precedent that he's in the course of the employment?
Exactly.
What does that mean?
Well, I guess that's why we're here.
Well, if he's going to and from work and he's going home, is that covered by workers' comp?
Again, there are variations on a theme.
Okay.
Me, Joe Blow, driving to work in my own car, if I get an accident on my way to work, no, that's not covered.
Okay.
If you're using an employee's, employee-sponsored form of transportation, if, say, an employee always uses a company van or something to go to and from work, then it can be compensable.
Is it important here that this incident happened? It happened on the employer's property, as you indicated.
It did.
Does that make a difference?
I don't think it does. I mean, certainly that's a factor that can come into play when you're looking at the overall facts and circumstances of the situation. However, there are any number of cases where injuries occur on an employer's premises where compensation is not awarded, so that's not a determining factor.
Suppose you were commuting in your own car from your own home to work and you were parking on the employer's parking lot. You got injured.
And the injury occurred in the parking lot? The answer in general is yes, that is compensable. Once you're actually on the premises. Again, there are cases, and we cited them in the brief, where, depending on what little twist or quirk of the facts are involved, it's found not to be compensable.
Well, then why don't you say that here you're driving the company car and you're on company property, that you're compensable, even though you're on your own deviation, detour, that is, for your own personal benefit? Why don't you say that's compensable?
Because this is not a commuting case. Lurk found that he was not going to and from work in the usual and ordinary manner in which he usually did. He didn't have this van all the time to go to and from work.
So if it had been his own car that he drove to work, would he be compensated?
If it occurred on the premises,
right.
Probably yes.
Counsel, isn't it occurred off the premise, he wouldn't be compensated.
Exactly.
Okay. Isn't that specific question with regard to the normal use? The Court of Appeals disagreed with Luke's finding that Mr. Ide did not normally use the van for work. And it's that, if you will, area of disagreement that ties into the possibility of getting compensation under the going to and coming from. Isn't that what the argument is?
They found that he did not ordinarily use the van in his work. They did not disturb the underlying finding that he did not go to and from work, commute using the van. That was his ordinary and usual way of going to and from work. They let that standing find, or let that finding stand.
So where you have problems is apparently the Court of Appeals' conclusion that this was service incidental to his employment.
Right.
Well, what should he have done? Just left the vehicle there? He's driving it. He's on the employer's premises. It's a half hour after he had checked out. But he was on his way out, obviously. And suddenly he discovers there's a flat tire. So, and his injury occurred not because he was driving the car, but because he was fixing the tire. And that, isn't that beneficial to the employer?
Well, if you ask my client that, he'd say, no, this has been a huge boondoggle to him. He's had to pay extra workers' compensation,
I'm sure he would,
et cetera, et cetera. That's a rather simple after-the-fact analysis. But,
yeah, but he's got to fix a repaired tire.
Someone had, I would readily concede, before that van could be used the next day at work, someone had to fix the tire.
Well, or otherwise it would have had to sit out there in the open. When did this occur, by the way?
6 o'clock in the evening.
And what day?
In February.
So it would have had to sit out there in the middle of winter, overnight, with a flat tire.
Not necessarily. Mr. Stevens was there, the foreman. He was still on the property, and he's the one who actually finished, fixing the flat tire.
Well, is there a maintenance division so that you maintained your own vans?
They had a maintenance person who was on staff who took care of things like taking care of the vehicles, doing any kind of maintenance vehicles. That was not Mr. Hyde's job. He never took care of the vehicles, never maintained them. It was not his responsibility.
Was he on at that time? The maintenance man, was he available?
The maintenance man was not there at that time.
Was there a telephone in the van?
Not in the van, but I believe there was a telephone in the shop.
Close by.
Pardon?
Close to where the van was.
Right.
Counsel, you started your arguments this morning by saying this is not a deviation, this is not a going and coming, it's not a number of things, and that this is kind of unique in Wisconsin workers' comp law. I've looked at the Wisconsin Treatise on Workers' Comp Law and seen nothing on it. But on Larson's, there is a section on acts benefiting employer privately. And it says, when any person in authority directs an employee to run some private errand or do some work outside his normal duties for the private benefit of the employer or supervisor, then the injury is in the course, any injury in the course of that work is compensable. Is that of any moment here? I mean, that you need a person in authority to direct an employee to run, do work outside his normal work activities?
I'm not entirely familiar with that section you've just quoted, but I think it has some applicability in this case. I mean, you've got a situation, he wasn't instructed to change the tire. In fact, his employer said, if I knew there was a flat tire, I wouldn't want Mr. Hyde changing it because I knew he already had back problems, and I had a maintenance guy who was there to do that type of work.
Well, and he wasn't on the employer's business, was he?
He was not. He was on an entirely personal trip.
Well, isn't that the issue in the case? He was on a personal trip, but then when he had the flat tire, didn't the purpose change? That is, the purpose then changed to where he's on employer's business by repairing the tire. And your theory is, maybe, but that was unauthorized and he didn't want it.
Not even so much that it was unauthorized. He's on a personal mission. The risk is personal.
Well, why wasn't just the argument the appellate court said that your client was benefited by the changing of the tire? That's what I think Justice Babich raised, that if the vehicle was going to sit out there wasn't this a benefit, and what's wrong with that analysis?
The very mere act of changing the tire, someone had to do it. In that respect, yes, it is a benefit to the employer. I think that's taken a way too narrow a view of the circumstances. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and we have here a guy who was on a personal errand. He was going grocery shopping. He was fixing the flat tire so he could go grocery shopping. And the benefit to the employer, we have to look, you know, what is he doing? What's happening at the time? He's on a personal errand. The tire could have been fixed the next day by the maintenance man.
That's why I asked about the record, whether he continued on his personal errand, and you're saying because of the injury he didn't, and then somebody else fixed it.
Exactly.
So what difference does that make? In other words, the still as to the benefit argument, that had he fixed the tire, completed the job, this would have benefited McFarland Pheasant Farms. And that's, I think, is the reason for the appellate court coming down with that, with their decision.
Obviously, that's what the appellate court thought. I think, again, that's taking too narrow a view. These workers' compensation cases, in terms of deciding whether an injury is within the context of employment, growing out of an incidental to employment, are a situation where you have to look at a lot of different facts.
Well, Mr. Wilson,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Weren't his actions reasonable? What do you think, had he been, I was going to say, a mile down the road, mm-hmm. And he got a flat tire, would that have made any difference? Was he expected to walk back, say that?
Called his employer, called AAA, do whatever.
What if he was walking to call AAA and he got injured?
I don't think that's compensable. Not if we start with the basic fact that he's already gone grocery shopping.
Well, let's put him. I like Justice Wilcox's example. Let's put him a few miles down the road, out in the country or something, so he doesn't have this shop right there, and he's running a personal errand. But then he has a flat tire. Now, it seems to me his alternatives are to simply let the thing sit because it's not his vehicle, and if anything bad should happen, if I should get struck by a car while I'm changing this tire or whatever, I'm not going to be covered if we go your way. Or he starts walking down the road to get somebody to fix that tire and is injured during the course of it. Now, it's all, changing the tire is all for the benefit of the, well, not all, but certainly benefits the employer, does it not? Rather than letting the car sit out there overnight in the middle of winter and on an abandoned, on a highway where it could be further damaged.
I agree that very act of changing the tire is to the benefit of the employer. But you have to go back to why he's out there in the first place. And it's not because he's on any kind of a work mission.
Well, is that the law? Sure, he's out there in the first place to do his own, but, I mean, I think I could find plenty of law that says that sometimes those missions can turn back into work-related.
Oh, that's true. One of the cases cited in the briefs, Barriger, says if an employee's work creates a necessity for travel, the trip at the outset is the employer's. If the journey would have proceeded, although the business was dropped, it's the employee's trip. Now again, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances and figure out, you know, is this deviation working to begin with? You know, whether his general mission is within his job duties.
Small changes in the fact situation change the result in these cases, don't they?
Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. You'll have a few moments for rebuttal. Mr. Bolton, you represent David Ide.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Rich Bolton. I'm with the Boardman Firm, and I am here representing the employer today, Mr. Ide. Right off the bat, let me disagree with Mr. Andrews when he says,
I'm having a difficult time hearing.
Let me disagree right off the bat when Mr. Andrews says this is not a deviation case, but then proceeds, in my opinion, to evaluate the case as a deviation case, as the whole concept of he was on a personal errand, he was on a personal mission. I agree that this is not a personal or a deviation or detour case, but my disagreement with the commission's decision is that it evaluates and decides the case as if it was. I don't think it's a deviation case because we begin, because the injury in this case, in the first instance, is still on the employer's premises. We're still on the employer's premises.
Well, that makes a difference. I asked other counsel. You feel that if it had happened 10 yards off of the property, it would have made a difference?
I don't know. I wouldn't, well.
Or a mile down the road?
Let me say this. I think it makes it a stronger case that it's on the premises. I don't think it's decisive if it was off the premises, but I think it's a much stronger case on the premises because the whole concept of workers' compensation is that there's a balancing here. The employee gives up common law causes of action for a more certain remedy, and similarly, there's a benefit to the employer. So the question then is, are we dealing with a situation that is related enough to the employment that it's going to fit within the statutory framework that we're dealing with? In essence, the question always is, when you're trying to determine whether something is incidental and arises out of work, is it because of the employment? And more particularly, when you start getting to the, you know, moving off the premises and you start changing the variations, it becomes, is it enough because? And in my opinion, if in this particular case, on these facts, it is enough because. You've got a situation, you've got the risk that he's exposed to, the position in which he's in, clearly, nobody disputes, arises from the employment relationship. He's on the premises, and in fact, curiously enough, the employer in this case says, probably if this situation had occurred using his own vehicle on the premises and he picked up a flat tire and was fixing it, there'd probably be compensation here. It is ironic that if he's leaving work with his own vehicle and he gets a flat tire, he'd probably be covered. But if he's leaving work with the company vehicle and he stops to fix the company vehicle, he's worse off.
Can you go back 30 seconds?
Sure.
You said that if he was driving his own vehicle, leaving the premises, and he got a flat tire and he stopped to fix the flat tire and got this back injury, he would probably be covered.
As I understood, and perhaps if we're on the premises.
Yeah.
That's what I understood Mr. Andrews to say, that he understood that probably...
I thought you were citing prior case law at us or something.
Pardon me?
Is that supported by case law?
If the flat tire occurred on the employer's premises,
yeah.
That particular factual situation, I'm not aware of in any Wisconsin case. I am aware of that situation where it's the employee's own car, in which probably the case that's most frequently cited is from Louisiana. It's Bates, B-A-T-E-S, versus Gulf States Utilities Company, with a citation of 193 Southern 2nd, 255. A situation where the employee had his own vehicle on the company premises, he comes out of work, he's got a flat tire, and he goes back. He goes back to the employer's facilities to fix the tire, and they said that even though, you know, in that situation that was covered. Another situation where somebody had a dead battery when he came out of work, and he went to get a battery charge, his employer's battery charger for his own darn. His purpose for getting that battery charger was to get out of work as fast as possible. But in that case, Burkle, B-U-E-R-K-L-E versus UPS, and that's from New Jersey, 98 Atlantic 2nd, 327, covered. And more recently...
In all of those cases, if I heard the opposing counsel right, the ordinary way of getting to and from the workplace was through the car.
Well, let me...
I mean, that's the qualification he put on those cases.
In those cases, the circumstances in which the injury actually occurred, in Bates, for instance, he was actually in the employer's shop because he'd taken his tire back there. In Burkle, he'd gone to get a battery charger. In an Arizona case, Delgado, he was actually inflating his tire.
Yes, but the chief's question, as I understand it, is that the vehicle, and that's why the vehicle is the vehicle that is normally used, and it's that normal use that's the thread that
for commuting.
For commuting.
So when he's on the premises of the employer and gets hurt with the automobile in some fashion, it's covered. If he were off the premises, it was not. That was my understanding of the cases now.
That he went off?
That he was on the premises, but it was the usual routine of driving to and from work.
In fact, in this case, he either got to work with someone else driving him, if I understand the facts, or he rode his bicycle.
Okay.
So let's say if he got hurt, we can change it from a car to a bicycle. And if he got hurt...
That's the curious thing. I mean, the interpretation then of usual and customary becomes idiosyncratic. You're not interested in how do employees typically, are they taking a typical mode and route? You're interested in how did this particular employee, everybody else may drive, but if he gets hurt in the car, then he's not covered. And so usual and customary becomes idiosyncratic.
Is that how the cases line up?
I don't think it is how the cases line up in this respect. I think that the cases talk about there being more than one. For instance, they don't say that there needs to be absolutely one beeline path off. They talk about there being more than one path. There can be more than one. And I think they talk about there being more than one mode. What they ultimately come back to is they say what that going and coming statute was intended to cover and to exclude was unusual and extraordinary either routes or modes of coming and going. And here, there's no question that that leaving the premises by vehicle is customary and ordinary, and that this employee, in fact, had done so in the past as a passenger. But if he leaves as a driver, he's not covered. And I don't think that that is the sort of extraordinary and unusual going and coming that is intended to be excluded.
Counsel, we have here as a finding of fact, which your opposing counsel says is supported by credible evidence, that after 5:30 he was at least initially not in the course of his employment, that he had punched out. Do you concede that there is, although you may disagree with it, that there is credible evidence to support that finding that he had punched out?
No. I'm practical enough to assume that factual distinction is probably not the legal issue you want to hear argued, but I don't agree in this respect. There was absolutely no evidence, no credible evidence, that this employee signed out. And in fact, on the occasions, in fact, when he had not used the mechanical punch out and had signed out, typically was when...
Let me...
Can you answer that?
Real quick, what I was going to say is, on those occasions when he admittedly had signed out, typically it was because they were leaving work from a different part of the farm, and actually what they would do then would be to sign out the next morning. Now, Mr. Ide, if you accept that he says this isn't my handwriting and I never signed out, and on the occasions when he typically signed out cursively, did it the next morning. He never went back to work after his injury. So what we know is that someone else apparently signed him out. But
We don't know that.
No, that wasn't the final. I mean, on 22 other occasions, he was only employed for 6 weeks. So assuming, I don't know if he worked a five-day work week or six or seven, but on all other occasions, I assume, it says 22 other occasions, he had handwritten the time in, and I testified that it was he who wrote in all of the other handwritten time notations. So isn't it credible you're saying there were 23, the other 22, he did write them in, but this one he didn't. Someone else did that.
Well, it becomes incredible if, in fact, on those 22 other occasions, he did it the next morning and he never returned to work after this particular injury. I mean, it becomes positively incredible because he never returned to work.
If that's in the record that he never returned to work on those 22 other occasions?
Yes, it is. In fact, what happened was the next day, he could hardly move. He called the employer, and someone from the employer took him to the hospital, and he spent the next 10 days in the hospital, and then he never returned to McFarland after that.
Counsel, Justice Bradley had a question.
Thank you, Chief. Assume that the finding of Lurk that he had completed work for the day. That he had completed work for the day, regardless of who punched in or punched out. Assume that that finding is supported by credible evidence. Is it your position then, that this flat tire brought him back into the course of his employment because he was benefiting the employer by fixing
it? I agree with that reasoning. But I would also say that I wouldn't necessarily reason from that he was already out of the course of employment.
In fact, you need that him still to be in the course of employment, I think, because take this as a hypothetical. Let's assume he is doesn't have to work on weekends. He finishes work Friday at 5. He's on the farm property, sitting on top of a hill, drinking, Sunday afternoon. And he's writing how to crate pheasants better. And he's coming up with a new idea that's going to benefit his employer on how to crate pheasants better. And he's doing this, and every time he gets a good sentence, he takes another drink, and he then falls off the cliff and injures himself. Now, what he was doing was benefiting the employer. Is that compensable?
If he's writing this...
How to crate pheasants better.
Yeah. I would not say that was compensable because that was not by any means... I mean, in a sense, what we're saying, what the argument is, that when the whistle blew, even though he did something, that if he had done it before the whistle blew, for instance...
Let me ask, if the employer on Friday night had said, sometime this weekend, I want you to come up with an idea on how to crate pheasants better, and then the other facts are the same, he was up there drinking and writing, would that be compensable?
I think that probably would be compensable.
And what's the difference?
The difference is that it would be an activity that would at least be within the realm of contemplation of this employment relationship.
Would the difference be perhaps that a person in authority directed the employee to do this activity?
No. And in fact, that citation from Larson's treatise, if I'm correct on that particular reference, it says it would be covered if directed to perform some service on the supervisor's private property.
It says, when any person in authority directs an employee to run some private errand or do some work outside his normal activities for the private benefit of the employer or supervisor, an injury in the course of that work is compensable.
Right. I don't think we really disagree. If he's directed to do something for the private benefit of the supervisor. But let me take your example here. You're saying that once the whistle blows, lift a hand to do anything to benefit the employer, you're nothing more than an officious intermeddler. And I don't think I don't think the case law supports that. For instance, if he had asked, can I use the vehicle tonight? And so it's intended all day long that he's going to take it, but he sees that it has a flat tire at noon, and he fixes the flat tire, or even he doesn't intend to use it himself. He simply sees that it has a flat tire during the workday and undertakes to fix it, even though he hasn't been directed to, even though there's somebody else that whose normal job that is to do. I think the case law in Wisconsin and elsewhere is that that would be covered. I don't think we recognize this concept that he would be nothing more than an officious intermeddler if he did that. And the implication is that if he goes beyond what he's supposed to do, that he almost assumes the risk. And I don't think workers' compensation is premised upon an assumption of risk concept either. And I think it's important then, you know, if he had fixed this tire before the whistle blew, would we say that this had absolutely no benefit to the employer? I think clearly if he fixed the tire before the whistle blew, even if he knew full well that one of the reasons he wanted to fix it was so that when he was done, he could go home or he could go shopping, I don't think it would be any different. And so the fact that it happened, if you accept that he was punched out or signed out at 5:30, but he still hasn't left the premises, I still don't think this is a deviation case, because what you're really saying is you haven't deviated yet, but you're gonna. And typically the deviation rule applies if when you actually take the detour, not whether you're contemplating taking the detour. And here we're really saying he's still on the premises. He hasn't left. And he clearly undertakes an activity that's beneficial to the employee. But we're going to essentially treat this as a deviation case, because although you ain't done it yet, we know you're going to. And I don't think that's consistent with the case law. I don't think it's consistent with a manageable rule. Because what happens then is, you say, suppose that he had fixed the tire. It's 5:30, somebody signed him out, and he's waiting to leave. He's waiting for Mr. Stevens to get done to take him, and he sees flat tire. And being a person of some initiative, undertakes to fix the tire, even though he's not going to take it with him. He's not intending to use it. He sees something needs to be done. I think that'd be covered. So what you end up doing then is saying, okay, well, what's different if he fixed the tire at 5:45 without intending to take the vehicle, but he fixes the vehicle at 5:45 with the intention to take it? The rule then becomes, what's your intention? And I think, quite frankly, once you deviate from, is the activity objectively beneficial to the employer, and say it may be beneficial, objectively beneficial, and it may be on the employee's premises, and it may be a flat tire that was caused on the employee's premises, but if you're intending to take this vehicle later, then it's not covered. Coverage then becomes premised on what was my subjective intent, which is very... First of all, as I said, I don't think it's a workable rule. But secondly, it's inconsistent with how the deviation rule has typically been applied. The deviation rule typically doesn't matter whether I'm intending to take a deviation. I'm only uncovered when I'm on the deviation. And here we're basically saying, yes, you're on the premises, and yes, it was a risk that arises, in my opinion, out of the employment relationship. In this respect, there's no question that the flat tire was precipitated and caused by some factor on the employee's premises. All of that doesn't matter, because you were intending, though, at some point down the road to take a deviation. You put the cart before the horse. You say, were you going to deviate? Well, if you were going to deviate, then we're going to measure when you're going naked, when you lose coverage, at the point of when you formed the intent. And again, it becomes, if intent becomes the element of when the deviation begins. First of all, as I said, I think it's inconsistent, but it doesn't take, I mean, presumably this employee would have been better off if he had said, my reason for fixing the tire was because I knew we'd need the vehicle tomorrow, and therefore I wanted to make sure it was fixed. And yes, as an incidental factor, I was going to take it that night. But it becomes very easy then to say my intention was to further the employee's purpose. By the same token, the types of things that are, I mean, we've already got a host of things that are found to be related enough to the employment relationship that they're covered even though they don't benefit the employer. The horseplay cases.
Mr. Walton, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
If you were going to write the rule for us in this case, what would your rule be? Tell us how you'd set forth the rule.
I would say that if the employee is undertaking, and again, on a different set of facts, I might craft a broader rule, but at least on these facts, in trying to craft it as narrow as maybe the court would need to, an employee on the employee's premises who is fixing or repairing the employer's instrumentalities of work arises out of and in the course of employment. Period. Now, you get a situation where at some point, you know, I think there's a zone. You don't immediately become beyond the scope of employment as soon as the whistle blows. Now, if he comes back, if he's been hanging around for 3 days with nothing to do, I mean, and becomes nothing, a little more than a loiterer, maybe the rule would.
Let me ask you. Excuse me for interrupting, but
pardon me?
I wrote the rule. I was writing the rule down. And I thought, well, we're talking here about allegedly a personal errand. So how do you write that in? That's an assumption that the two courts and the clerk made, that this was a personal errand. Does that change anything at all under your rule that you want us to adopt?
Not for me, and I'll tell you why. The conclusion that He had the giddy up to get off the premises. He wanted to go, but he hadn't left. But he hadn't departed the premises yet. But we will say, therefore, he had begun his personal journey before he's left the employee's premises. If we're going to measure the departure from the course of employment before he even crosses the boundary of the employer's premises, then everybody on Friday afternoon who's leaving work, quite frankly, is on a personal errand. They may want to go home. They may want to go grocery shopping. They may want to pick up their kids. Everybody at the end of the day, quite frankly, wants to be somewhere else frequently. And if we say that the personal errand, that the deviation for a personal undertaking doesn't begin once you've actually deviated from the employee's premises, but as soon as you form the intent that you'd just as soon be somewhere else, then in some employment situations, you know, the employee's mental state of whether he wants to be somewhere else begins even earlier than 5:30.
Well, how do you like this? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
How do you like this rule? If the employee is allowed to use the company car and is forced and undertakes repair of the employer's car, the company car, within a, on the company premises, and within a short time that employment had ended for the day, the employee is covered for any injury.
I think that's a...
You think it's terrific?
I think it's a terrific rule.
Something like last 25 words.
But I think it has the attributes, first of all, of being workable. I think it has the attributes of being consistent with what we're trying to do. You know, imagine a situation, for instance, where he's fixing the tire, and Mr. Stevens, the co-employee, comes along while he's doing it, and in some fashion or another, Mr. Stevens is injured, and Mr. Stevens sues Mr. Ide, because Mr. Ide somehow was negligent in causing his injury. This ball of facts in this case, in that situation, is not so far removed from the employment relationship that it's beyond the scope of the Workers' Compensation Act. So I think it's the test, as you've articulated, is workable. I think it's consistent with what the statute's attempting to accomplish. I think it's consistent with the case law and how the cases have previously applied.
What's the legal language of the law that we're interpreting, that this rule that I have just brilliantly crafted applies to? What's the language?
Pardon me?
What is the language in the statute that we're interpreting here?
I think you're interpreting the arises out of an incidental.
That arises out of an incidental. You think my rule?
The statutory language is growing out of an incident and incidental to his or her employment.
So this means that a farmer who has a 500-acre farm, someone wants to go use his truck to go hunting with, and he never gets off the farm, and he drives around, he's always employed under the rule.
Say that again.
In this case, we have a pheasant farm, but a typical Wisconsin farm where you have a couple of farm trucks, and an employee wants to use it for a personal, he wants to use it to go hunting with, or whatever. That's a personal, but he drives on the property under the rule that we're looking at, regardless of whether it's personal errand or not, we're expanding the workers' comp to cover that situation.
I don't know if it would cover that or not. This is my thinking.
He's using a company car. He's undertaking repair of the company car on company premises. Within a short time of employment ending, he's covered. That's the rule you've said you'd like to adopt. Justice Wilcox has given you an example that fits within it.
See, the example, though, I think varies the articulation in this respect. Presumably, again, it sounds like the time frame has been varied. I don't, you know, within a reasonable time after the conclusion of the employment. But more importantly, in that situation, you're not contemplating, a personal errand. You've undertaken it. And here, the concept that, so again, now to make this more comparable, suppose that his intention, he's asked if he can use the vehicle, and he's going to use the vehicle. He hasn't yet gone to the Far 40, but he's intending to. But before he even undertakes that trip, he undertakes to fix the flat tire. I think that would be closer to the situation. There are certainly situations where, even within the 8-hour workday, where employees on the premises, nonetheless are found to have deviated so far from the employer's purpose. For instance, you've got obviously the case law and the workplace tolerates a certain level of horseplay within the 8-hour day. But if it gets, there's a level at which horseplay, even during the workday, isn't covered. There's a case where, I don't recall the name, where the employee tragically put his head in a...
That was a Nickberg case.
Right. And even though that was on the premises and within the confines of the two whistles, you know, that wasn't covered. But we don't have that situation here. We don't have an undertaking. What Mr. Ide did was undertook to fix a tire, and he doesn't have a rifle over his shoulder out trudging through the cornfields looking for pheasants to shoot. I mean, he is still within, in my opinion, Mr. Andrews said, you know, even though he's still on the employer's grounds, he formed the intent and therefore he assumed the risk. I would disagree completely. I would say that was still an employer risk. He was still within the zone of employer risk that is intended to be compensated, particularly because the very occurrence that he's responding to is not only fixing an employer vehicle, but fixing an employer vehicle that picked up a flat tire on the employer's premises. So, my time's up. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, could I ask a couple of questions? What kind of a vehicle was this?
That was being chained? It was a van. If you ask me what make and model, I couldn't tell you, but it was a van that the employee... My recollection is that the employer had a...
So, Ben, how long was the employee for the flat tire?
How long was he in the van before the flat tire occurred? I don't know how to answer that in the sense that there's not a finding by either the examiner or the commission. The testimony by Mr. Ide, which I think is the only evidence that would really speak to this issue, was that he was coming back from the breeding pens on the farm and ran over a nail. And and was aware that on the trip from the breeding pens that he picked up a nail. And quite frankly, whether he had actually then got back in and drove 100 yards or 200 yards, I really don't know. I don't know.
So if your position was adopted, he really wasn't leaving to go and buy groceries, is that correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
If your position had been adopted by the finder of fact, he wouldn't even have left yet to buy groceries. Is that right?
If the testimony, if our, in terms of just the raw facts, the raw historical facts were accepted by the commission, that he had a flat tire and still contemplated doing further work before checking out. Again, I think that there'd be no question. In my opinion, I mean, the question was still, and I'm not sure if I'm anticipating what you're thinking. You know, if the nail was picked up in the tire before he checked out, I'm not sure that makes a difference, because the point in time that we're concerned with is the point of the injury. So in terms of the historical facts, we would say that he hadn't quit. I will acknowledge that the commission felt that he had completed, and I would, in my opinion, whether it was before the whistleblower or after, on these facts, is not decisive. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Andrews.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does in the law, does contemplation of what the person is going to do control as to what is the reality or personal or company conduct?
I don't know if there's a good answer to that. I don't think it's necessarily a key factor. It's something that may be considered.
Sure.
Chuck, Justice Cooks and Justice Wilcox both asked Attorney Boland for a rule that they would apply in this case. You haven't asked me for one, but I'll give you one anyway.
That was coming in just a minute.
Here's the rule that I think is a bright line rule that's workable, it fits within existing case law, and it makes sense. Once someone is done working for the day and is embarked on a purely personal errand, no subsequent injury is compensable, even if it occurs during an act that has an arguable benefit to the employer, provided that the act was not done at the request of the employer, and provided that the act was not part of the employee's regular work duties. The rule makes sense. It fits within existing case law. It's a fairly simple rule. It's obviously tailored somewhat to the facts of this case, but I think it's broad enough to encompass other situations that can arise. We have here...
Do you agree, counsel, that if he had got hurt changing his bicycle tire, he would be covered?
Changing his bicycle tire?
As he was leaving the premises after having completed his work.
Perhaps. I guess I'd have to look at the parking lot cases. I know there's one Oscar Mayer case where, you know, a question, I guess, of whether that changing the tire would be a deviation then from the ordinary coming and going.
No. The reason I use bicycles is because that's part of the record, that's the way he normally came. So let's assume that's the way he normally came and gone, and there's no deviation. He did what he did 100 times before. He got on his bicycle in the parking lot and started taking off, and suddenly he had a flat tire, so he started to change the bicycle tire.
Well, the deviation there, I guess, would be changing the tire. That's not in the usual course. There's a case cited in the briefs, Oscar Mayer, where an employee was in the parking lot, and instead of going around a barrier with a wire across it, which was her ordinary and usual way of getting to her car, she tried to step over the wire, tripped, fell, was injured. That was deemed not to be compensable.
Counsel, it seems to me under 10203 sub 2 that your answer to Justice Babbage should be yes. It reads, any employee going to and from his or her employment in the ordinary and usual way, the bicycle, while on the premises of the employer or while in the immediate vicinity thereof, if the injury results from an occurrence on the premises, ... is performing services growing out of an incident temporal to his employment. Under that rule, isn't Justice Babbage's hypothetical, or maybe real, bicycle that's used ordinarily and customarily as the way means to go back and forth, isn't that covered?
Probably. I guess it would depend on whether the flat tire was an occurrence and whether there was a deviation.
That's 102.031C2.
I proposed a rule. If you want to go the other way and do what Mr. Ide urges and find a compensable injury every time there's an arguable tenuous benefit to the employer, you could run into a lot of bizarre hypothetical situations.
But isn't that whole problem in dealing with workers' comp? You've got a whole set of bizarre circumstances. Can't foresee what the next bizarre circumstance is going to be. And it's, workers' comp is not limited to getting hurt while you're doing the employer's job on the employer's premises from 9 to 5 if that's the work day, right?
Right.
And so these cases all turn on one minor fact deviation from another. And it's hard to find out what the principle here is, the working principle.
Well, that's why I go back to the statute, growing out of an incidental to an employment, the way that's been interpreted by any number of these cases, that say you have to look at the time, the place, and the circumstances of the injury. The latter part of that phrase, the circumstances of the injury, has been interpreted as meaning an injury while an employee is fulfilling his or her job duties or engaged in doing something incidental thereto. Changing tires, maintenance of vehicles was not part of Mr. Ide's job.
Thank you very much, Mr. Andrews. That completes the hearing on 97-1659. Justice Babbage will be out in a few moments to meet with the class, and the court will reconvene at 1:45.